Love Osho podcast brings you the real stories of the people whose lives have been inspired and transformed by Osho. We explore why thousands of people are falling in love with Osho and where to find them. Take a deep breath and enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to the Love Osho podcast. My name is Swaram and I'm the host. Today our guest is Swami Anand Haridas. Haridas is a scholar, translator and teacher. Haridas specializes in Indonesian and Malaysian literature and translation studies. He received the degrees of Doctor of Philosophy in Malay Studies from the National University of Singapore and Doctor of Creative Arts from the University of Technology, Sydney. Besides his academic studies, he has translated extensively from Indonesian and Malay, from Vietnamese Francophone writing, and co-translated from Hindi Osho's discourses on devotional Hindi poets. Haridas fulfilled Osho's hope that these poets might one day be known to the world at large. Hello, Haridas. Welcome to the Love Osho podcast. How are you?
I'm good. Good to talk to you.
It's my absolute privilege and pleasure. I'm really thrilled to have the opportunity to discuss with you your story with Osho, your life as a sannyasin, and talk about your writings, your work in translating Osho's words from his native language. So you have an impressive academic curriculum. I understand that you took sannyas in 1977 when you were already dean of the School of Humanities at Margaret University in Perth. That must have been quite a shock for your fellow academics. So let's start from the beginning. Tell us a little bit about how you came to know about Osho.
Okay, I came to know about Osho because there were sannyasins who began to appear in the Murdoch community, some half a dozen. And Murdoch in Perth was close to Pune. It's actually, I had an interesting experience in Darshan when someone said they came from Sydney. And of course, that's the big city in Australia. And Osho leaned forward and he said, "Is it near Perth?" "No." You know, it's like, I come from Rome. "Oh, is it near London?" "No." But for Osho, Perth was the center in Australia where sannyas was going to grow and going to be tremendously important to society. So some of my students came with that background. And at first I was a little bit suspicious, I suppose. I'd spent 10, 12 years studying Asian, teaching about Asian culture, immersing myself in Southeast Asia, in Indian culture, going back to very early period when I was meditating with Heinrich Zimmer, Philosophy of India. We'd go out in the hills behind Sydney. I did come from Sydney originally. And so it seemed very easy. But gradually I read the books, thought about what he was saying, felt about what he was doing. And one day as I was driving home, it was one of those real epiphany moments when I drove over the hill into the sunlight and I thought, why not? Let's do this. So I did it. And that was September 1977. Let's do it. So I wrote and took sannyas. It was a bit of a shock for the university community, no doubt. They didn't know what to call me. They didn't know how to treat me. I decided that I would live in an Indian way, in a sense. So I cut the legs off my desk and sat on a cushion on the floor because I thought that was more comfortable and better for the health. So it was difficult for people to place me in that situation. And the whole idea of having a Swami on the faculty was more than people could handle for a long time, I think. Yeah, just didn't make much difference. Totally changed my life, yeah.
Wow, okay. So, and then how did you combine your profession and academic commitments with being a sannyasin? And then I would love to hear about the first time you traveled to Pune to meet Osho in person.
I basically always had the sense with Osho that you could be a sannyasin in so many different ways. And they depended on your background. They depended on your aspirations and how you saw your future going forward. And for me, I saw being a sannyasin for myself as living an ordinary life, not rushing off to an ashram, not rushing off to Pune and spending the rest of my life there, but continuing in what I did. And Osho talks in various places about sannyasins being ordinary and in this way being extraordinary. In the marketplace, sannyasins as teachers, sannyasins as doctors, sannyasins as garbage men, whatever. That was his subversive plan to get sannyasins into all sorts of positions in society, not to move outside it. Some did, of course, and I respect them, but some stayed doing what they were doing as sannyasins, just being a witness with a mala around the neck, the orange, the open attitude, the respect for others, but yeah, that sort of way of being sannyasin in the world was what was important for me.
Wonderful. Yeah, it sounds like a bit the Sufi way. Osho talked about that.
Yeah, I'm working on his Sufi speeches about Yari at the moment. Yari is the latest translation book, and we'll talk about that later, but Yari is a Sufi. So I'm now starting to think about Sufis as well.
Perhaps I picked up the vibe. Okay, so when was the first time you met Osho, and did you have any one-to-one meetings, or did Osho ever told you anything specific to you?
Because I was in the marketplace, in a sense, I met Osho rarely and for brief periods. And my first darshan was really where I met Osho. It's in the book, God's Got a Thing About You. I think I was naive. I didn't quite know what went on in darshan. And people went with their deepest problems and their latest argument with their girlfriend and pain in the back. And I was very into the whole Indian culture, and particularly fond of Krishna, the figure of Krishna, as a lover, as a philosopher, as a man. And so I said, can you tell me something about Krishna? And of course, Osho, thinking, who is this guy? Who's Krishna? Is Krishna his girlfriend? Is Krishna his boyfriend? And eventually I get to the point of saying, no, just Krishna. That's all. And he says, well, what would you like to know about him? And being the academic, I'm not an Anand for nothing, my friend. I say, perhaps about Krishna as a teacher. Manisha has a little comment. He doesn't usually answer academic questions, but turns this one into a pointer for the questionnaire. Bong, one down for me, two up for, I want to talk about my girlfriend. A pause. And then he talks about the masters of that kind. They each have a different message. Jesus has a message of service and redemption. Buddha is about meditation. Krishna is about celebration and redemption. And he then talks about celebration and redemption. Don't just be an Anand, get into it, move out. And he even quotes Bhagavad Gita to me, which was quite remarkable. In a sense of what happened in darshan, to be quoted Bhagavad Gita, not remarkable in the sense of Osho's background, of course, as professor of philosophy. And he quotes a verse, famous verse, 1866, chapter 18, verse 66. Sarva dhamma parajichai mamekan sharanam brij. Abandon all dharma, all doctrines, all teaching, and cling to me. And I look at him and I think, cling to me? Is this the big sale or is this the big what? Okay. But he explains it and he says, but good, your interest in Krishna is good. So whether anyone else asked him, he really gave me a very special answer. an answer that respected where I was coming from with my background, my interest in Indian philosophy and practices, and the affirmation, you don't have to ask about your girlfriend, your interest is just good, but very good. And I found that liberating to be who I was, what I was. So it was good. I enjoyed meeting Osho when I think back on it.
That's really wonderful. And it's quite unique, as you say, because normally when I hear Osho answering those type of academic questions, he would normally bash the questioner and turn it into more personal. But in your case, it was personal because that was your life. So that's very, very beautiful. That he really encouraged you to carry on with your life and with your interests. So let's get into that. Let's talk about this wonderful, beautiful interest you have for literature, for poetry, for translating words from Asian languages into English. And specifically, you translated Osho's words from Hindi into English. So for me, the way Osho expresses himself in English is already very impactful. I mean, he masters the language beautifully, yet it's not his mother tongue. And his command of Hindi, from what I hear from Indian friends, is far superior than English. So perhaps we can start by, if you can give us a bit of a general idea of what you have noticed in the difference between when Osho speaks in Hindi versus English.
The difference is tremendous. I think in Hindi, particularly when he's speaking on devotional poets, and then in the Zen tradition, he's speaking from the heart. And he's speaking out of a very rich tradition of devotional bhakti poetry. And he doesn't need to joke so much. He includes poems. So we have poems upon poems. It's very rich. It's very musical. It's very emotional. It really carries you along with it. And sometimes in English, particularly towards 1980, when he stopped speaking, it seemed as though he was getting tired of the English. And yet in the Hindi, the speaking of Yari, of Sahajabai, Charandas, Dayabai, all these writers, he was still extremely poetic, extremely involved. So when you're translating, when I'm translating from the Hindi, I'm translating a special dimension of Osho, the really love for literature, for feeling, for emotion. And one of the reasons I did these translations with people who had good Hindi, because I didn't, was because Osho himself said this should be done. So if we look at, refer to another book, Books I Have Loved, Osho might have appeared to be anti-intellectual, but in fact, he was an extreme intellectual for much of his life. And how many books a day did he read? 20, 30. Yeah, the numbers, enormous. Books I Have Loved is 100 books that were important to him. And when he talks about Sahajo, even the name is poetic, and he says, I hope one day these talks and Sahajo's poetry will be translated into English. He doesn't see English as a very poetic language, but he still wants what he says to be released into English. And a few chapters later, when he talks about Daya, he says exactly the same thing. Daya is a little cuckoo. Not nuts, cuckoo that way, but cuckoo like the bird calling at twilight. Pay attention, pay attention. And again, he says, I want these to be translated. So I wrote and said, I would like to translate Sahajo. And Puna wrote back and said, we're sorry. Thank you for asking to translate Daya. No, I wanted to translate Sahajo. But that's being done. So my colleague, Mrs. Joshi, and I translated the Daya text. And there were two of us translating it, Mrs. Joshi, native Hindi speaker and myself, with emphasis on the English. And then it was edited by Ma Satyam as well. We don't get into the book as translators. We get in as editors. And Ma Satyam, bless her, wherever she is in the universe, is equal balance, equal standing on this panel. When the book is republished by Jaiko, we disappear. So that's real renunciation for the guru. Yeah, we put all this work, and it took us almost 2 years to do it. And we did the talks because there were Osho's discourses on Daya, and they needed to become English. They needed to be spread. I think people need these, not just short little clips of the anthologies, but Osho at full strength, full pace, over 10 discourses, really becoming deeply involved and involving his audience in the sort of questions that those people thought were important and that he thought were important. In the end, he wasn't talking about Sahaja, he was talking about Osho, but he started with Sahaja. So for me, it was important to bring her and Daya, who was her sister disciple, and Charandas, who was their teacher, to bring the set into English. We did that.
And wonderful. I mean, I haven't, unfortunately, had a chance to read, but I'm sure it's incredibly valuable. And I'm wondering, why do you think Osho was so particular in saying, I wish these words to be known to the world at large?
I think because he thought it was important that people should know about these writers, that they had special rasa, special juice to be shared to the world. And maybe he wasn't certain it would happen. It was just a wish, a hope that this might happen. But it happened. It was launched in Pune in year 2000, went into several editions. We got increasingly dropped from the list. And it was an interesting experience. I was very proud of the translation. One of the things that happens in Hindi books translated into English is that they become less culturally specific. So Daya is what is called a sant, S-A-N-T. And there's not a lot of ways of translating that. You could translate it as a saint, and that doesn't quite do it. But the saints were poets and mystics who sang their devotion. And they begin with Kabir, they include Mira, and they come down in the 17th, 18th century to Daya and Sahaja. And in our translation, it became enlightened mystic. So this cultural specific got transferred into an American or a European philosophy of the divinity in a very general sort of way. Whereas it might be, this is about Rama, this poem, and becomes in the English translation edited, this is about divinity. This is about the divine in human being. So I'm not always happy with the Pune editing of these, partly because they do take out the cultural specificity of it. They rewrite it, and I don't think they're always representing what Osho is saying. You don't know what a sant is, and you don't know that Kabir and Sahaja actually share things in common. So some of this is lost.
Yeah, it's a real pity, and here there are lots of controversies around editing Osho's words, especially when it comes to translating from another language, and if someone that is editing is not a specialist, then... But let's leave it like that for now, but it's great that we have the opportunity to clarify this, and hopefully everyone that will read those books and can bear this in mind, and also acknowledge that you did the translation.
Well, partly also it's that the Pune people expect the books to be ventriloquism. They don't say they're translated. This is how Osho spoke in English about these Hindi poets. And that's a requirement. You appreciate it, and I think most people appreciate it. We can hear Osho saying these things. When in fact he never said them in English. He said them in Hindi and he said them differently. But this is the product. We're glad to have it, but we have few reservations.
I understand. But in fact, the other even more complicated question is how to translate Osho speaking in Hindi into English, because I'm sure there are like massive issues there. For example, even Osho was saying that the word, the simple word dhyan, meditation, the way it's translated into English, it doesn't really give the sense of what that means in Hindi or for the Eastern tradition, because it's something to do more with no mind, whereas meditation for us, it's about concentration, contemplation, it's something to do focusing the mind. It's, you know, we just don't have in the Western culture the dimension of beyond the mind. And translating poetry, devotional poetry, I believe it takes it even to a more difficult level of complications. So maybe talk us through how you go or you went about that.
There are two ways to go about this. One way wasn't possible. One way is to write a long introduction to talk about what meditation actually means for Osho. So rather than expect people to pick up the book and get it from the book, a foreword, an introduction. This is what Osho is speaking about. And in this sense, you have to have someone outside the book, someone who is not Osho, saying this is what you need to prepare for reading Osho properly. So a respect for translators, if I can put it that way, and having translators as visible. The main effort is to make the translator invisible. And when my name and Mrs. Joshi's name disappeared, we were totally invisible, and glory to the guru. But to say, no, these are translations from Hindi, and they're going to have certain features in it that we need to put a footnote to or a glossary to or an explanation. Dayabai was a sant. Keep the word in the original. A sant is a mystic poet in a certain tradition who sings about their love for God. And those sort of extended explanations can help as well.
I understand.
I believe in invisible.
Yeah, well, I guess in a deeper sense, it happened, and even though it's not the way you envision that. But
no, I think when you do it, you have to say, that's it, my child, go into the world and look after yourself. And if it's published this way, if it has that shape, you can't do anything about it. You can complain, and I complain to you because you're a friend, but it's no use me complaining to Pune. It's no use me complaining to Jaiko in Bombay. There's the book. It's my child. Look after itself. It's gone.
It's unfortunate. You specialize in the tradition of devotional poetry. Yeah. And devotion is somehow looked with skepticism in the Western world. But something that fascinated you, and it's a big part of Osho, especially in the discourses you mentioned before, that when Osho spoke in Hindi, he spoke from the heart. So I live in the Western world, and somehow I aim to transmit something from Osho to other people, and I see that this element of devotion doesn't go very well. It's very difficult to speak about it. So how would you explain what devotion is to a young man or woman in the West today?
Probably what I do is talk about it as positive attitude, an attitude of respect, an attitude of seeing the universe as on my side. And these are people who are developing an attitude. In Hindi, it's towards God, but in the West, it's towards life, towards consciousness, towards the way things are, that is positive, accepting the world, treating it as an equal, listening to what the world has to say, what other people have to say, not judging, not condemning, but this is an opening of the heart. And if people don't read poetry, that's all right. They can go and read something else. But for people who read poetry, these are interesting things, good things to read. I don't think you can justify it to everybody. But Osho would have said, first thing, music is not for everyone. Poetry is not for everyone. Devotion is not for everyone. It's a special type of person. We rejoice for them. We rejoice for the other people who have their own path, their own attitudes. Read something else. It's easy.
I like that. Yeah, it's true. And Osho himself is not for everyone. I find it hard to understand because Osho is such a genius to me, but hey, what to do? So you are also the author of two books about Osho and sannyasins. One is The Laughing Swamis, a book on Australian sannyasins, and also Osho Rajneesh and His Disciples, which is a collection of articles on Osho and the sannyas movement. So I'm very interested to hear more about the second book, the one about Osho and the sannyas movement. So I'd love you to give us a bit of a sense. I mean, normally I would read those books before the interview, but now I'm in Greece. I ordered some books on Amazon and they never arrived. They are stuck somewhere because of pandemic, COVID, the island, the transport, whatever. So unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to read your books. So can you talk me through the second book?
Second book is Osho Rajneesh and His Disciples, Some Western Perceptions. So it's two things. It's a collection of short articles and other writings about Osho and sannyas that are scattered in magazines. So I bring those together. And the second thing is it's a work of love. It's Swami Anand Haridas saying this is what you need to have to begin to understand Osho and sannyas. So it's love and it's articles. And I try to keep it fairly balanced. Some of the articles are four. Some are again. Some of them are just confused. I don't really know this or that. And it's divided into four sections. First on Osho, Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. And it begins with Peter Brent, very early description of Acharya Rajneesh. It includes Devaki on Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, a new man for all seasons. So Devaki is, of course, very devotional and very dedicated to Osho. Robert Kushner on Osho on Karma, Swami Anand Jina, in other words. So there's another devotional article. And then a skeptical psychologist, the narcissistic guru. So you've got four views, read them, think about them. This is 1999. I then have a section on community, the ashram, a provocative community, different people's experience of living in Pune, living in America, Portland, Oregon. Who lives in Utopia? So some academic studies, some personal studies of what it was like to be in those places at those times. Third section's about meditation and therapy. So a psychologist, Swami Anand Vireshwar, on jealousy. And the fourth section on conflict and renewal, because at that time what happened at Rajneeshpuram was still fairly raw. And so different points of view on that. Was great experiment. It did great things. Was a disaster because it exploded the movement. It really started very bad relations with the neighbors and so on. And so what I'm trying to do is give people opportunity to consider the different aspects, not just say, this is what it was, take it or leave it, but think about this. Look at that. Get this person's experience. Get this person's feeling. Get this person's problems, where they really didn't care for the narcissistic guru with 93 Rolls Royce. Why 93 Rolls Royces? So it's that sort of book. And I think it's, I can't say it's a good book, but I will say it's a good book. It's not used in universities. It's not a great hit in a sense, but it's important for sannyasins because it's got different points of view and different ways of looking at the movement. And it's actually got a picture of Osho with no hat. And you believe of all the things I got from Pune, hey, you shouldn't have a picture of Osho with no hat because he was bald. And he started wearing the beanies shortly after that. So it's there. People can use it as they want. And I think that's part of what I'm doing. It's there. What people use it for, what they do with it, I'm not responsible for it in a sense. I'm responsible to me, responsible to Osho to get it right, to express it the way I see it, which may not be the way other people see it. Then it's gone. It's out there in the world. My grown-up children.
Yes, that's great. And for me, I'm curious to know, because the book was written in 1999, now we are in 2020, and many of the arguments that you mentioned have become quite relevant to today, also because of the famous worldwide country, especially when it comes to the events you mentioned about Rajneeshpuram. So I'm wondering, if you were to write the same book today, would you change something?
It's a good question. It depends what you see the Rajneesh movement now compared to 1999. When I wrote The Laughing Swamis, it was just after the collapse of Rajneeshpuram. It was when sannyasins were no longer wearing red. It was when we thought, hey, this whole thing is dead. Yeah, if I can use that word, it's finished. It had so much to offer and it's no longer relevant. And I think the thing in 2020 is to say, well, in what ways, why did it die in one way? How was it reborn? What's important from the continuity? What things can we still gain from this? I think you being a sannyasin, I'm nearly 80. You know, I've been around a long time in this and I've had various relationships to the movement, to Osho, and I'm still there. I still my master. I still love him. But someone coming new will see a very different movement from what I saw. So I think I'd have to write a whole new book. I'd have to interview a whole new group of people. Laughing Swamis in the present tense. These people were cooks. These people were teachers. These people were blah, blah, blah. When they came to Osho, this is how they felt. This is what they said. And that works. And Laughing Swamis is 1994 already. Yeah, probably half. The sannyasins in the world weren't even born in 1994. I don't know. Interesting question. How old are sannyasins these days? How old are sannyasins do you know? What's the average age?
Well, I know a lot of the oldies because for me, those are the real sannyasins I love the most. But then I've slowly come into contact with many new sannyasins. I myself kind of mid 40 almost. So I don't know as many as like 20 years old, but in my age, I know quite a lot of people actually. Yeah, there are many sannyasins.
Yeah, 45 is a good age for sannyas, critical age. You've gone so far in life, you've had achievements, you've had disappointments, you're ready to put it together and move forward. When you're 80, you know, if you can keep moving at all, it's great. Of course, you do, you stay open, stay with a heart. Open. One of my other stories was not Osho, but it's Osho inspired. It's when I went to Pune in 1978. I did a Vipassana group. One of the activities we had was to run three steps and jump. Three steps and jump. And I thought this was a rather ridiculous thing, but okay, it's what we're doing. So I went out. And one of the things that I wanted in a way was for people to call me Baba, B-A-B-A. Yeah. Swami's very formal. You just call me Baba. And I'm running, jumping, see these kids in a tree and think, oh, that looks slightly ridiculous. I'll just run. And the voice came from the tree, these kids. Hey, Baba. Ah, oh, excellent. You're calling me Baba. What about the jumping? Sprung. They caught me. And it's a question that I've carried through from that point. What about the jumping? If it looks ridiculous, do it. If it feels strange, do it. Don't worry about other people judging it. Do it. Don't forget the jumping. I'll have that on my gravestone, I'm sure. Hey, Baba, what about the jumping? Jai.
And you wrote that book in 1999. Do you think today is still relevant to write such book? Do you think it's important to reflect on Osho's legacy, on what's going to happen, even in the future? I'm not just talking about the present, which is a bit confusing. It's hard to reflect on the present for me because I'm involved in it. But thinking of the future and Osho's message and Osho's ability to potentially transform humanity and make this world a better place to live, more conscious, more loving, more compassionate. I don't know, because I'm thinking of myself, I'm doing these interviews, I always think of writing a book. That's why I was really interested that I didn't know that you wrote it already in 1999, you were writing this kind of books.
But it's time for a new one. It's time for you to do it. Do it from your perspective with the people you know. And it's a social transformation that begins with individuals. What about the jumping? You have to do it. I have to do it. All sannyasins have to do that personal transformation. Osho would say this, yeah? Don't go out and change the world. Change yourself and move on from there. And someone will do it. And if they don't do it, Swami, you have to do it. It's scary, isn't it?
Yes, it is, but that's exciting at the same time.
Yeah, because you could do it well.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, absolutely.
So what is the biggest challenge you experienced in your life as a sannyasin?
That's a question, isn't it? I think some of the challenges are continuing to be a sannyasin when the sannyas, if I call it sannyas movement, is not going in the direction that you want to go. So when the Pune ashram closed down in 1980 and people were spilt around the world with not very much support or backup, what's this about? When Rajneeshpuram closed down and people were spilt around the world and very reliant on their own resources, what's that about? And I was in a limbo state in a way between 1983 and 1985, the Rajneeshpuram time, because it wasn't for me. And many people found it very joyful, very happy experience. Some people found it very difficult because it was very disciplined experience. But as soon as Osho left America, I came back full in and I helped found the center in Melbourne. And it was just, yes, Osho, yes. We really want to get this going. We want to make it public. We want you to know that we care here. And so disagreements with the movement, but always love for the master continues through it. So was it difficult? Yeah, sure. Was it transformative? Very much so. Yeah. You can become complacent, I guess. If the movement's always doing what you like, what you approve of. But if it's working out sannyas as a river flowing and changing all the time, then you have to be very aware where you are in the river, where the currents are, where you want to be, where you are prepared to be. It's a journey, as the statement has it. No destination. You just keep going.
And you already mentioned that the most important part is individual responsibility and individual connection with Osho and this ability to take the risk and take the jump. But if you look at, you know, the Sangha, what the Buddhists call the Sangha, that you mentioned the movement, having other sannyasins around, I think, you know, meditating together is a big part of the journey. What do you see is happening today? I don't know if you're still in contact with sannyasins, if you're still interested in it, but obviously there has been a lot of issues, especially after Rajneeshpuram, as you mentioned, that kind of blew up and changed a lot. And now, after 30 years, and Osho is no more in the body, there are many different centers around the world, Pune Ashram, or, well, the resort, the commune and the resort now is definitely no more the central point of the sannyas movement at all. I mean, for various reasons. So what do you see is happening today?
I have two answers. Being a translator, you always have two answers. One is the transformation of sannyas into something else. We don't necessarily have to expect it to continue forever. Maybe we shouldn't have expected it to continue this long. The impression I got when I went to Pune in 2000 was, where's the master? Where's the heart of this community? And it was disappointing. So one answer can be, it's changing its importance for me. And it's changing the way it is in the world. And many good things have a certain lifespan, certain karma. And once that's gone, so be it. And the other one is to say, no, that's a bit negative. It's realistic and it's accepting. And I think it's maturing. The other one is to say, well, I'm committed to this. And Osho and Osho's message is important to me. So I'll do what I can. I'll do podcasts. I'll write about Sannyas 2020. I'll write about this particular poet that Osho speaks about. Yari, that's in the new book, As If a Tree Started Running. Nobody knows in English speaking who Yari is. And my Hindi speaking colleague had hardly ever heard of Yari at all. And he thought that Yari was conventional Hindu mystic. He was a Muslim. And suddenly we're thrown into this whole new realm of exploration and understanding of what the Muslim approach to personal experience within the universe, what it is, how it's expressed, the idea of light. This comes back to our devotion. Light in everyone and everything. So seeing the world in positive, spirit-filled terms, really being turned on by life, by the way that things are around you. So that transforms as well. So if it's dying, maybe. If it's living in me, then it's living in the world, and I do what I can do, what I do well. And sometimes not so well. It's okay.
Beautiful. So for you, what are your latest projects? What are you working on?
Well, three things. The Yari, obviously. I've talked a bit about that. Hindi is one area. French from Vietnam. So Francophone, Vietnamese, writing. And particularly a man called Pham Duy Khinh. I'll send you the details. He wrote a very beautiful book called Legends from Serene Lands. And it's published in Hanoi. So nobody in the Western world's ever going to read it. But it's such a beautiful collection of short stories. So I really got involved in Vietnamese culture and life. And the other translations are more Indonesian. Because that's where I start. Indonesia and Malaysia are the cultures that are my second soul, my second realm of being. They say if you have a second language, you have a second personality. You have a second world in which you live. And I'm sure that's true. So I'm rich. I've got plenty.
Yeah, exactly. I was about to say. So you translate from Indonesian, Malay, you just mentioned Vietnamese. We spoke about
French.
And French.
From Vietnam. Yeah, so it's Vietnamese writers writing in French.
Yeah, I see. Okay, so we're looking at four Asian languages, all very different from English, your mother tongue.
Yeah, and Osho thinks English is not a very poetic language, and I have to do the best I can to make it poetic. And the things that I come across, the legends are just beautiful little stories in their own right. Story of a girl in a tower in the Middle Ages, falls in love with a fisherman who sings a long way away. And she gets to see him, and he's ugly. So she doesn't love him anymore. He goes away, dies with a broken heart, is buried, reburied. They dig up the grave, and all there is a little diamond. And they take the diamond, and they make it into a cup. One day the girl looks into the cup, sees the fisherman in a little boat sailing around inside the teacup, and she weeps. Cup breaks. And that's the realization, I really did love this man, after all. Yeah. And there's a little explanation goes about how we're born to love already people we haven't even met yet, but we know from before. So it was disaster then. It's probably a disaster again coming up. And they're beautiful little stories, and they're very worth sharing with people. Kids love them, adults love them as well. It's good to be a translator.
It's such a valuable work you're doing, you know, to make these beautiful devotional stories available to a wider audience, people who would never be able to access that because of the language limitation. So thank you so much for doing that. It's great.
And so, the other thing is that maybe people won't read Osho on Daya, but Osho says, read Daya. And so we translate her poetry, and Osho's mentioned in the introduction. So first they read her poetry, then they think, well, Osho thought she was important. I wonder what Osho says about her. So they go and buy the discourse translation, and little hooks along the way to bring people in to the message.
Amazing. And I will link all of the books you mentioned in the show notes. So anyone that is interested, that has a receptivity and an interest in devotional poetry, can find your books there.
Yep. Amazon.in for India. Don't worry about Amazon in New York. Go for the Amazon in India.
Okay.
And they will have Songs of Dayabai, Sahaj Prakash, the books on Osho, Laughing Swamis, Osho Rajneesh and his disciples. Please buy them. I don't get any royalties. They keep the message alive and spreading.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's what we're doing here in part.
Yep. It's great.
Okay, so I've got three final questions.
Gee.
Three final questions, yes.
Okay.
So the first one is, what is Osho's greatest contribution to the world?
Greatest contribution is the sense of individual freedom, self-respect, and responsibility to take hold of who you are, be the best, be caring, be loving, Don't hurt people, but do what you can. Don't forget the jumping. First question.
So the second one is, what is the most beautiful gift you received from Osho?
Osho. just the verse, abandon all doctrines and cling to me. I think himself continually giving is the gift of Osho to me and to everyone.
Okay, so the last question is, you leave the Osho experiment. What does it mean to you personally to be with Osho today?
It means exactly those things that I'm talking about. He's the master. You bow down to him. You learn from him. You don't always agree with him, but you understand why he's doing certain things. You understand that sometimes when he says, go down the road, walk on the right, he's not speaking to you. You have to walk on the left. So picking up when he says, walk on the left, Swami. Okay, that's me. I better line up and get on that side. Being aware of his message and what it means, how it applies to you, not to everyone in the whole universe, is the path.
I found this really, really fascinating, and it's so insightful because Osho said everything and the contrary of everything, and it's so confusing at times. And he spoke to so many different people, and sometimes I hear him saying something and I think, does it apply to me or not? And I think there is the game, and that's exactly what you just described. It's so beautiful, you know, really amazing. Thank you for that.
That's the game, and it means you have to take responsibility. It's not guru adoration, so he's God, and he's always right, and he knows you intimately. In the end, he'll say this because he knows you won't accept, and the fact that you won't accept is part of the process as well. Maybe I shouldn't, maybe I should. Let me work out why, what I'm going to do.
Yes, yes. So on this note of taking individual responsibility, we can end this very, very insightful interview. I really thank you so much for your time. You're so busy with all your commitments. So I really appreciate taking an hour of your time to discuss with me and talk about Osho, devotional poetry, and your work, your writings. Well, I just can only thank you, thank you, thank you for being part of the Love Osho podcast.
Thank you for inviting me. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Lots of love. Bye.
Lots of love. Take care.
And you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it and leave a review. Visit loveosho.com for more episodes, blogs, or to connect with us.